Right then, I think we ought to start. So welcome to everyone here, and welcome to everyone on the podcast. And anyone who didn't get the thing I sent out last week about the argument that we tried to do, can you email me on that address and I'll bounce it on to you. And I'll make sure that the thing that I sent out to everybody here is also available online for the people looking at the podcast later on. Right, well, this week we're going to do different types of argument. So, whereas last week we learnt how to set out arguments logic book style. Do you remember? How is that done? What is it for an argument to be set out logic book style? Come on, got to get you warmed up, haven't I?
Premise,
conclusion, that's right. You identify the premise and the second premise if there is one, and the third premise if there is one, and then the conclusion, that's right. And the way I did it was just to label them premise one, premise two, conclusion. But you could just put the premise one, premise two, and then a line, and then the conclusion. There are different ways of doing it. Okay, we dealt with ambiguities. Hold on one second. How much did you miss? Okay. We dealt with ambiguities. Do you remember there were different sorts of ambiguity? What is an ambiguity? Can anyone tell me? Start off with, what is an ambiguity? It's a word or a phrase that has two or more meanings. That's right. So in the context where it is, it could mean two different things, which is very confusing. And there are different types of ambiguities. Can anyone remember a couple of these types? No?
Linguistic.
Sorry?
Linguistic.
What do you mean by linguistic? You might...
Different meanings for example, is...
Right, okay, that's lexical. A lexical ambiguity is one word which could mean different things. So rum could mean the drink, or this is strange, or something like that. Or we use the example of bank, which could be all sorts of things. So it could be a verb as well as a noun, all sorts of different things. And there are also structural ambiguities, where you have every pretty girl loves a sailor. Does it mean there is a sailor such that every pretty girl loves him, or every pretty girl loves some sailor? So there are different sailors who are loved by pretty girls, or just the one. And then there's ambiguity of cross-reference. Does anyone remember what that is? Or anaphora, you might have been taught in school. An anaphoric reference is when you have a pronoun that links back to a name. So Jazz doesn't want Jane to come to the party because she doesn't like her. Do you remember that? Mm. The she becomes ambiguous and the her becomes ambiguous. Okay, and then there were ambiguities of sound. So the picture of water, do you remember, could be a picture or a picture. Mm. With a T or, oh well, they've both got T's, haven't they? A picture of water or a picture, a drawing of water. We then learnt to identify conclusions and premises, and we learnt there that although that sometimes there are conclusion and premise indicators, what's the only foolproof way of identifying the conclusion of an argument? Anyone tell me? Sorry?
The role in a sentence.
The role that it plays within the argument rather than within a sentence, because of course a conclusion will be a sentence. That's exactly right. So, and what role is played by the conclusion? It's the sentence that is that's being asserted, exactly so. And the premises, which you can also tell in a foolproof way only by the role they're playing, are what? The reasons being given for the conclusion, exactly so. Okay, and then we went to eliminate irrelevancies, and that's where we got into a bit of hot water, isn't it? Because you were all accusing me of throwing things out just... for fun. But I hope that those of you who got the thing that I sent around see that actually what makes something relevant or irrelevant is the conclusion, because once you've identified the conclusion, that you have the argument, because the premises are the reasons for that conclusion, and anything that isn't a reason for that conclusion is irrelevant, isn't it? So even if it seems very important, like God, I mean, what could be more important than God, perhaps? I'm afraid he gets left out if whatever's said about God is not a reason for believing that conclusion. We identified suppressed premises, and we saw that sometimes you have to put a suppressed premise in and sometimes you don't. When do you have to put it in?
It's controversial.
When it's controversial, good, that's right, because you can't leave it out of an argument if it's controversial. It would weaken the argument to have it in because it's controversial. When can you leave a premise out?
When it's understood from the general context and it's obvious.
When it's blindingly obvious, when all you'd be doing is sort of eking out the argument. So I'm going to take my umbrella, you know, do I have to say because it's raining and if I don't take an umbrella I'll get wet and I don't want to get wet. No, of course I don't. You understand immediately when I say I'm going to take my umbrella. And finally, we learnt how to make terms consistent. What did that involve? That's right. If we had something like two words that meant the same thing, or two phrases that meant the same thing, so it's raining and it's pouring, we could just choose one of them and get rid of the other, because all it does is confuse us. And we did the same thing with the cat is innocent and the cat hasn't sinned. I said in the context of this argument, there's no difference between them. Okay, so that's what we did last week, bit of revision for us. So now we know what arguments are, and we can distinguish arguments from other sets of sentences. Do you remember we can distinguish them from conditional sentences, for example? And we can analyse arguments and set them out logic book style. Okay, so you're not doing badly, are you, for lecture three? But we haven't yet started on how to evaluate arguments. And that's important, because some of you last week were having trouble with the analysis of an argument, because as you were analysing it, you were trying to evaluate it as well. So you were saying this premise isn't true. Well, maybe it's not, but all we're interested in at the moment is whether it's a premise or not. We're not interested in whether it's true or not at the moment, but we will be. So we're not even going to be able to start on analysis this week. What we're going to start on this week is looking at two different types of argument. And it's very important to be able to identify the two different types of argument. So we're going to look first at the normativity of critical reasoning. And of course I'll explain what normativity means. We're going to look at the relation of following from. We're going to look at the two main types of argument, and we're going to learn how to distinguish these two types from each other, deductive arguments from inductive. So in critical reasoning, we're concerned with whether or not an argument is good. So importantly, it isn't a purely descriptive discipline. A purely descriptive discipline is one that tries to say what the world is like. So zoology, for example, will attempt to describe a different species. So it'll attempt to categorize living things into species and into genuses and so on. And then it'll try and describe each species and so on. But it doesn't really get into shoulds in biology. I mean, you might get into a should where all you mean by should is you're talking about normal. Something's being normal, so you're really talking statistics. So cats should have four legs, you might say. Well, yes, indeed, they should. Statistically, most cats do have four legs, but this isn't a moral should. Whereas with critical reasoning, we've got what's called a rational should. It's normative. It lays down standards for us to follow. A good argument is an argument we want, and we want it because it's good. So critical reasoning is a normative discipline. We're interested in when a conclusion follows from a set of premises, and when it follows from a set of premises, it's good. Okay, so we're interested in arguments that are good, and that's when an argument follows from a set of premises. And we're also interested in which arguments are bad. I mean, you need to be able to identify bad arguments as importantly as doing good ones. So following from is a very important relation between premises and conclusion. And there are broadly two varieties of following from, and that's what we're going to learn to distinguish from each other today. Both deduction and induction are varieties of following from. So a conclusion may follow deductively from a set of premises, or it may follow inductively from a set of premises. And really, these two types of arguments exhaust the types of arguments there are. There are arguments within each type, but deduction, an argument is either deductive or it's inductive. And there are three questions you can ask to determine whether an argument is deductive or inductive. And here are the three arguments. I'll let you, sorry, three questions that you need to ask. And of course, I'm going to look at each and explain them. Okay, anyone have any questions so far? No? Okay, let's... Right, the first property that distinguishes deduction from induction is the fact that a good deductive argument is truth-preserving. And bad deductive arguments aren't truth-preserving, and inductive arguments are not truth-preserving at all. So if an argument preserves the truth, it is a good deductive argument. If it doesn't, it may still be a deductive argument, but it's a bad one. And no inductive argument ever preserves the truth. So what do I mean by an argument being truth-preserving? Well, an argument is truth-preserving if and only if, and that IFF is not me misspelling if, by the way. Whenever you see IFF, I suppose it could be an error, but it usually means if and only if. So you get the if going in both directions, if P then Q and if Q then P. So an argument is truth-preserving if and only if it's not logically possible for its premises to be true while its conclusion is false. Okay, so it's a very strong relation. This is the relation of entailment. So premises entail the conclusions when it's not logically possible for a set of premises to be true and a conclusion false. And just before we look more closely at that, you've got to be able to distinguish logical impossibility from physical impossibility. This is actually crucial for a lot of philosophy, but it's particularly crucial for critical reasoning.
Speak a little slower.
Am I going too fast? Okay. Okay. So, let me go back to this one. An argument is truth-preserving if and only if it's not logically possible. So this is why you've got to know the difference between logical impossibility and physical impossibility. If it's not logically possible for its premises to be true and its conclusion false. So we've got to be able to distinguish logical impossibility and physical impossibility, and by the same token, logical and physical possibility. Something is physically impossible if it's inconsistent with the laws of nature. And it's logically impossible if it's inconsistent with the laws of logic. And something's inconsistent. Two things are inconsistent if they can't both be true together. Okay, so if the laws of nature are as they are, and something is physically impossible if it can't be the case consistently with the way the laws of nature are. And with physical, logical impossibility, it's the laws of logic that matter. So it's physically impossible for a human being to swim 3 miles underwater without breathing apparatus. Do you see that? If somebody told you they'd done that, you would know that they were not speaking the truth, because it simply can't be done. It's also physically impossible for a cat to talk intelligently about Kant. I mean, even Oedipus, I talked to him about Kant for years. He still doesn't talk back intelligently about it, or even unintelligently, come to that. But both these things are logically possible. Logic has nothing to say about whether my cat discusses Kant, and it has nothing to say about whether you can swim underwater for 3 miles without breathing apparatus. It's logically impossible, on the other hand, for a square to be a circle. So all those people like my father who talk about squaring the circle, it's nonsense. You cannot square a circle, because if something's a square, it cannot be a circle. And you can tell that just from the very ideas involved. And a man can't be a married bachelor, because if he's a bachelor, he's not married. And if he's married, he's not a bachelor. Just like if something's a square, it's not a circle. And if it's a circle, it's not a square. We know that. And we know that a person can't have exactly 3 and exactly 4 children. These things are ruled out by logic. In other words, it's in the very nature of the concepts, square and circle, married and bachelor and so on, that we don't need to leave our armchair to know that there are no square circles. This is why it's so comfortable to be a philosopher. So here's an exercise. Give me 2 examples of states of affairs that are logically possible but not physically possible. Can you do that? Can you give me 2 examples of states of affairs that are logically possible but not physically possible? So if you remember, one example was that my cat can't talk intelligently about Kant. And another one is that a human being can't swim for 3 miles underwater without breathing apparatus. Can you think of another example like that?
The sun's so hot I froze to death.
The sun's so hot you froze to death. I'm not sure that isn't a logical impossibility. I mean, because you're working on the words freeze and hot, aren't you? And actually, they logically exclude each other, don't they? Go on, have a go.
Pigs can fly?
Pigs can fly, that's a very good one, yes. Flying pigs, as far as logic is concerned, flying pigs are fine, but yes, there are no pigs that can fly. Yes, you might have been looking at the... Okay, any other examples?
No, I didn't see that.
Yes, you might. I believe that you believe you didn't see it, but it's a bit like you sort of see it. And,
yeah.
Yeah. Can anyone think of another example of something that's physically impossible but logically possible?
I can jump to the moon.
Good. It's logically possible for you to jump to the moon, but it's physically impossible, isn't it? Yes, good. Okay, I think you're getting the idea. Anyone else want to have a go?
I saw through the wall.
You saw through the wall. Good. Yeah, that's physically impossible, but logically it's fine. So there are lots of things like this that are physically impossible, ruled out by the laws of nature, but not ruled out by the laws of logic. And of course, there may be worlds out there that have different laws of nature. And so... when we want to know what's going on in those worlds, it's to logic that we look, not to the laws of nature, because they're not going to tell us what these worlds are like. Can anyone give 2 examples of states of affairs that are logically impossible? Okay, so you might say being frozen by a hot sun might be a logical impossibility. Anyone think of another logical impossibility? So,
It's raining cats and dogs.
Funny enough, that's a physical impossibility. It's not a logical impossibility. Actually, it does rain frogs occasionally, I understand.
But actually does. Burnt by ice?
Being burnt by ice? It depends what you mean by burnt there, doesn't it? But actually, if you put your tongue on the ice in the Antarctic, you are in trouble. And it's actually called a burn, isn't it?
A female boy?
A female boy, yes, that's a good example of a logical impossibility. Yep, okay. Anything else? It's quite difficult just thinking of examples, but I hope you're getting the idea of the difference between physical and logical impossibility. Logical impossibility is inconsistent with the laws of logic. It's actually ruled out by the very concepts involved. And physical impossibility is ruled out by the laws of nature. So whereas logical impossibility can be determined a priori, in other words, we don't need experience of the world to determine what a logical possibility is, because all you need is the concepts. With physical impossibility, you need to know what the world is like. Science tells us what's physically possible and impossible. So what about these? By means of genetic manipulation, we can produce pigs that are able to fly. Is that physically impossible, logically impossible, or are we unable to tell?
Physically.
It's physically impossible, that's right. I mean, actually, maybe by genetic manipulation, we will produce pigs that can fly one day, if we think we want them. John has exactly twice as many siblings as Janet. He has Susan and the twins.
Logically.
That, do you see how that's logically impossible? If somebody told you that, you'd think for a minute, but then you think, no, that can't be right. And the reason it can't be right is if he's got three siblings, then he cannot have exactly twice as many as Janet has, however many Janet has. Muon neutrinos can travel faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. Physically possible, logically impossible?
Physically, for a moment there, we thought it might be logically
possible and indeed physically possible, but some of these microscope is shaking or something. Okay, visitors have succeeded in building a time machine. Is that physically impossible, logically impossible, or such that we can't tell?
Physically. Can't tell.
We can't tell on that one because it looks as if time travel is logically impossible, because if you could travel back and kill one of your parents before you were born, then do you see the logical inconsistency that we get there? Well, if it's logically inconsistent, it shouldn't be physically possible. But there are physicists who argue that it's not only not logically impossible, it's physically possible. If you look on YouTube, if you put in time travel physically possible, you'll get up a physicist who believes that it is physically possible. So I'm not going to say. I think I'm inclined to think it's logically impossible. Mm-hmm.
Marianne, is there a point about all of this in the sense of you have to almost as a caveat or that says, given what we know today?
With physical impossibility, that's exactly what we have to say, yes, because the laws of nature, we may be able to work with them to produce a pig that can fly. I mean, obviously, we can't work against them, but as things currently stand, flying pigs are against nature. But logical impossibility seems more fixed because the laws of logic seem more fixed. But actually, quantum mechanics, for example, has called into question a couple of the laws of classical logic. So whereas there's a distinction between the laws of nature, i.e. the natural uniformities that govern our world, and the laws of nature that we put together, i.e. our descriptions of the natural uniformities, do you see the difference? So there's the laws, our laws, if you like, and the natural uniformities that we describe. In the same way, the laws of logic, there's our description of these laws, and there are the laws themselves. And we may have the wrong description and may need to tighten it up at some point. So we can't be sure we've got the right understanding of either type of law. But it's certainly true with physical impossibility that it's malleable according to our physical knowledge. So, well, let me just ask, are there any other questions about physical and logical impossibility before I move on? Because it's quite an important distinction.
Christopher? Would Quine have produced an argument against logical certainty?
He certainly challenges it. What he challenges is the existence of analytic truths. So he doesn't think that there are truths that are not revisable.
Okay.
Okay, so an argument is truth-preserving if and only if it's not logically possible for its premises to be true and its conclusion false. That's the definition we had up there before. And it's important to notice that the actual truth value of the premises and the conclusion is irrelevant to determining whether an argument preserves truth. So have a look at this argument. All heavenly bodies revolve around the earth. The sun is a heavenly body, therefore the sun revolves around the earth. Do you see that if those premises are true, the conclusion must be true?
Yeah.
Do you see that? But the conclusion is false, as is at least one of the premises. Okay? Do you see that? So we have an argument that preserves truth, but doesn't generate truth. So that's the importance of the distinction. You've got to distinguish between an argument's preserving truth and generating truth. And if it preserves truth, what you're saying is if there is truth in the premises, there will be truth in the conclusion. And that suits this argument very well. So if these premises were true, the conclusion would be true. It would have to be true, wouldn't it? Couldn't possibly be false. It's logically impossible, in fact, for that premise to be, that conclusion to be false if those premises are true. And that's what it is for an argument to be truth-preserving. So if an argument has that property, then it's called valid, as we'll discover next week, and the premises entail the conclusion. This is a good deductive argument, and that's so even though the conclusion is false. Can anyone tell me why, we'll look at this a bit next week, but can anyone tell me why the property of being truth-preserving is useful even though you can end up with a false conclusion? Why should we care that our argument should be truth-preserving even though you could end up with an argument with a false conclusion?
Because you can trace back to find the false premise.
Good. If an argument is truth-preserving, you know either that its conclusion is true, if its premises are true, or you know that if the conclusion is false, at least one of the premises must be false. And of course, you can look back to find which premise is false. And of course, if this is all swans are white, the thing in Swan River in Australia, if it's a swan, will be white, but it's black, you know that one of your premises is false. So it can be empirically very useful to have the property of truth preservingness in an argument. So we can be certain of an argument that preserves the truth that it's a good deductive argument. So it's not just deductive, it's also a good deductive argument if it preserves the truth. And we can be just as certain that if an argument doesn't preserve the truth, then it's either a bad deductive argument or it's an inductive argument. Okay? So it could be one or the other, but it's certainly not a good deductive argument. So let's do this exercise. Which of these following arguments is truth-preserving? In other words, is a good deductive argument. Have a look at them yourself and put your hands up when you think you've got the answer to one, let's say. Hand up when you think you've got the answer to one. Tom is a banker. All bankers are rich. Therefore, Tom is rich. Okay, lady there in the...
That's a good deductive argument.
That's a good deductive argument. Does everyone agree?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep, okay, you're absolutely right. If Tom is a banker, and if all bankers are rich, then Tom must be rich, mustn't he? There's no question about it. So that's a truth-preserving argument, and it's a good deductive argument, therefore. What about Sue and Tom lead similar lives, but Sue smokes and Tom doesn't? Therefore, Sue is more likely to die from heart disease than Tom. Put up your hand when you think you know whether that's truth-preserving or not. I'll let a few more put their hands up first. Okay, do you want to tell us? Do you think it's truth preserving?
No, because I think it's missing something.
Yeah.
As it is, no.
Okay.
I'll stop there.
Well, as it is, no. And that's because there is a possibility that the conclusion is false, even if the premise is true. And why is that?
Because it doesn't make any link between smoking and heart disease. There needs an extra premise.
Right, and is it a premise, I mean, it could be a premise that we just want to leave out, or it could be a controversial premise. What is the, well, actually, no, don't let's borrow it. You're quite right, there is something left out, and that premise could be true, and that conclusion false, so we know that that argument doesn't preserve the truth, so there could be truth in the premises, but no truth in the conclusion, so it's not truth-preserving. So either that's a bad deductive argument, or it's an inductive argument, and we'll see later which it is. What about all dogs are mortal? Lucy is mortal, therefore Lucy is a dog. Put up your hand when you think you know. Okay, gentlemen there?
Not.
It's not truth-preserving, that's right. Okay, it's actually it's a bad deductive argument, this one, isn't it? And we'll see why it is later on, but yes. So all dogs are mortal, Lucy is mortal, therefore Lucy is a dog. Those two premises can be true and yet that conclusion false quite easily, couldn't they? Lucy might be human and mortal. What about number four? Have a look at that and put your hands up when you think you know whether it's... Gentlemen there?
It's a good deductive argument.
Everyone else agree?
Yes.
Number four.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. I thought you were wrong, but actually I think you're right. Killing is wrong, therapeutic cloning involves killing, therefore therapeutic cloning is wrong. Yeah, exactly. That's a good deductive argument. If it's true that killing is wrong, and it's true that therapeutic cloning involves killing, then it must be true that therapeutic cloning is wrong. Okay? So if you want to deny that, you'd have to go back and deny one of the premises, wouldn't you? You have to say one of those premises is false. Okay, what about number five? Hand up when you think you've got... I've given this one away, haven't I?
Yes.
All right, let's go. What?
It's a bad deductive
argument. No, all you need to say at the moment is it's not a good deductive argument. It's not truth-preserving. Actually, it's not a deductive argument, as we'll see later on. Every person with Huntington's disease who's been examined has had the HD gene on chromosome 4, therefore everyone with HD has the HD gene on chromosome 4. You see, that could be true and that could be false. I mean, it's true that it's unlikely to be false, but it could be false, couldn't it? It could be that we just haven't examined any of the HD people who've got the HD gene on chromosome 5, perhaps, or whatever. Is there any biologists in the room? You can. What about this one? If the liquid is acidic, it will turn litmus paper blue. This liquid does not turn litmus paper blue. Therefore, this liquid is not acidic. Hand up. Lady there.
Me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is a good argument.
Okay, everyone agree?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Okay, so we've got a feel for when an argument is truth-preserving or not. And we know that if it's truth-preserving, it is a good deductive argument. And if it's not truth-preserving, it's either a bad deductive argument or it's an inductive argument. So that's the first question that we ask to distinguish deductive arguments from inductive. But it would be reasonable to ask at this point, perhaps, why is deduction useful? I mean, if we believe the premises of good deductive argument, and it's logically impossible for the premises to be true and the conclusion false, then to believe the premises is to believe the conclusion, isn't it? Do you see that in a good deductive argument, the conclusion doesn't go any further than the premises? What is contained in the premises is contained in the conclusion. So you actually, in a way, you learn nothing from a deductive argument, a good deductive argument. It doesn't tell us anything we don't already know. It's just, it gives us the logical consequences of what we've already known. Well, if human beings were perfectly rational, and believed all the logical consequences of all their beliefs, then deduction wouldn't be useful. The reason it is useful is because we're not perfectly rational. We often need the consequences of our beliefs spelled out to us, and that's what deduction does. And I just love this sentence, so I put it in. I slightly changed it to make it even better, but it came from Mark Sainsbury. Okay, so a deductive argument: if the premises are true, then the conclusion must be true. There is no logically possible situation in which the premises are true and the conclusion false. That's a good deductive argument. One question.
Sorry, just back a little bit. Mm-hmm. On the need for the conclusion or not, does the conclusion not link the two premises in a way that wouldn't have happened without the conclusion?
Yes, I mean the conclusion is a logical consequence of the two premises taken together.
That, it links them.
Well, it links them because you've got to put them together in order to get the conclusion. I mean, so if you have all heavenly bodies revolve around the earth, is that what I had? I can't remember what it was. No, it is logical. That this is truth preserving. But if you only had that premise without that one, then that one wouldn't logically follow, would it?
No, but you were saying it didn't advance knowledge anymore, but it linked premise one and premise two.
It links them
in a way that wouldn't otherwise have happened.
That's certainly true. I mean, the fact is that belief is a consequence of that, a logical consequence of that belief and that belief. So it links them because you need both those beliefs to get that. Does that satisfy you?
Yes.
Good. Okay, now where were we? There we were. Okay, the second question that we ask to distinguish deductive arguments from inductive arguments is the matter of whether the conclusion follows from the premises an either or matter? Or is it a matter of degree? So does the conclusion follow from the premises either definitely or definitely not? Or could you say, well, you know, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. So let's have a look. If it's an either or matter, the argument is deductive. Okay, so if it's either good or it's bad, then it's a deductive argument. If it is a matter of degree, it's not bad. It's better than the last one or something like that. Then it's an inductive argument. So we know that the conclusion of a deductive argument follows from its premises if and only if the argument is truth-preserving. So if a deductive argument is not truth-preserving, its conclusion doesn't follow from its premises. It's either it does or it doesn't. It's either truth-preserving or it's not. It can't be anything in between. So the evaluation of a deductive argument is an either-or matter. Either the conclusion follows from the premises or it doesn't. There's no maybe, no degrees of following from at all when we're talking about deduction. Okay, here's a good argument. All bankers are rich. Deepak is a banker. Therefore, Deepak is rich. Do you see that if those premises are true, the conclusion must be true? And here's a bad one. All bankers are rich. Deepak is rich. Therefore, Deepak is a banker. Do you see that those two premises could be true without the conclusions being true? And we can see that immediately, can't we? Yes. There's no maybe here. One is good, one is bad, and there's nothing in between. And that's always the case with deductive arguments. Question over here.
On the killing one, killing is wrong.
Therapeutic cloning.
Yes.
Yeah.
Didn't say all.
Let me go back and see what it did. I think it implied all, but let me see.
I mean, if you were arguing with someone on that one, you'd say.
So yes, killing is wrong, therapeutic cloning involves killing, therefore therapeutic cloning is wrong. You mean this doesn't say all killing is wrong?
Yes.
No, but it does imply it, doesn't it? I mean, it says quite generally killing is wrong.
Right, there's no degree there.
The only way you could make that conclusion false is by making that not true. In other words, you'd have to say some killing is wrong,
most killing is wrong,
right.
But it's not the case that all killing is wrong.
Okay.
Marianne, can I just...
Yes, that was a perfect... That was a good objection.
Just follow up. If you then said there's a question of degree around the therapeutic cloning, sometimes it involves killing.
Well, then you would be falsifying that premise. Yeah. So with this argument, it's a truth-preserving argument in that if that premise is true and that premise is true, then that conclusion must be true. And if you don't think that conclusion is true, you've got to question either that premise or that premise. And you could question them in the ways that you've just discussed. Yeah. Any questions about that? No, let's go on to, now I've forgotten my Buell. Okay. So you can see one is good, one is bad, and that's always the way it's going to be. So when a deductive argument is good, when it's truth-preserving, i.e. when its conclusion follows deductively from its premises are conclusive reason for believing its conclusion. Okay? It's either good or it's bad. So if it's good, then its premises are conclusive reason for believing the conclusion. And that's because deductive arguments are monotonic. Okay, so here's a new word for you. At least I assume it's a new word, maybe it's not. Deduction is monotonic. And what that means is that we can add anything we like to a good deductive argument without making it bad. You'll also see that we can add anything we like to a bad deductive argument without making it good. We cannot, if a good argument is good, if a good deductive argument is good, it's conclusively good. And if it's bad, it's conclusively bad. So there's nothing we can learn that would change a good deductive argument to being a bad one. So let's have a look. Here's a good deductive argument. Would you like to have a go at giving me a premise that might change that from a good argument to a bad argument? Have a think about it.
Some bankers are
all
rich.
All good bankers are rich.
Sorry?
All good bankers are rich.
Well, that's not adding a premise, that's changing one of the premises that's there, which is not playing the game, sorry.
Some bankers are rich.
Okay, you're adding that as a... I'll tell you what, let me show you what I've got, what I thought you might come up with, because I think that might be easier. You could try putting in... What have I tried to put in there? I can't remember now. Hang on. So I tried to add, it's not the case that Deepak is a banker here. So there's the argument, first premise, second premise, and conclusion. And I'm adding that in the hope that that might make it a bad argument. Okay? Do you think it does make it a bad argument?
No.
Okay, it doesn't, does it? It certainly doesn't change it from, if all these premises are true, this conclusion is true, does it? Because actually, if all these premises are true, anything follows from a contradiction. And we've got a contradiction in here, haven't we? Do you see? So anything follows from it. And what about this one? What have I added here? No banker is rich, so I've contradicted that one. But we've got exactly the same thing, haven't we? It hasn't gone from being the case that all the premises are true it's been the case that if all the premises are true, the conclusion must be true again. So with deduction, you've got absolute, it's conclusive. It's either good or it's bad, and there's nothing you can do.
I'm not sure I understand that.
Okay. Well, let me do the bad one and see if that helps, and if not, we'll go back. Okay, so by the same token, we can add anything we like to a bad deductive argument without making it good. Once again, there's nothing we can learn that would change it from a bad argument to a good argument. So I think I've done that. Okay, here's a bad deductive argument. All bankers are rich. Deepak is rich, therefore Deepak is a banker. And I've asked again the same question. Is there any premise we could add to that that would change it from a bad argument to a good argument? I've got a couple of that I'm going to try, but let me just say, if I put something in here that's false, okay, do you see that I'm not changing it from a good argument to a bad argument? If something in there is false, then it's not the case that all the premises are true. Therefore, the conclusion doesn't have to be true either. And if I put something in there that's true, then, or if all the premises are true, the conclusion will still have to be true. Let's try that. Sorry, I'm not convincing myself at the moment. okay, so I've put in here, it's not the case that Deepak is a banker. So all bankers are rich, Deepak is rich, it's not the case that Deepak is a banker. So I've contradicted the conclusion there.
Yeah.
Okay, does that change it from a good, from a bad argument into a good argument?
No.
Has it become truth-preserving?
No.
No, it hasn't. Has this become truth-preserving?
No.
No? And you'll find that nothing you can add will change it from being not truth-preserving to being truth-preserving. And in exactly the same way with a good argument, nothing you could add would change it from being truth-preserving to being not truth-preserving. Let me do one more thing.
So I'm okay.
You're okay there.
Where I was confused is I thought that you're actually making, you were still saying it was a good argument, and I wasn't seeing that. I think it was a bad argument.
What you're not doing is changing it from a good argument to a bad
exactly.
argument, or indeed from a bad argument
exactly.
to a good argument. But let's have a look at induction. So, okay, this is what I'm claiming. Either if a deductive argument is good, its premises are conclusive reason to believe the conclusion. There's nothing we're going to learn that's going to change that. And when a deductive argument is bad, then its premises are no reason whatsoever to believe the conclusion. And again, nothing is going to change that. It's either good or it's bad, and that's the end of it. And that doesn't mean that the conclusion of a bad deductive argument might not be true. Do you see that? It means only that its premises are no reason to believe the conclusion. So I think I'm going to give you a... So here's a bad deductive argument. If it's Monday, Marianne will be wearing jeans. Marianne is wearing jeans, therefore it's Monday. It is a bad deductive argument, isn't it?
Yes,
good, thank you. I've got to the point where I can't. okay, but is that conclusion false?
No.
It isn't, is it? No, it is Monday. But it's not, our reason for believing it's Monday doesn't depend on that argument, does it? Or at least I'd hope so, because if it depended on that argument, it... But so you can have a bad deductive argument with a true conclusion in exactly the same way you can have a good deductive argument with a false conclusion. So if you have a good deductive argument with a false conclusion, you know what? What do you know if the conclusion of a good deductive argument is false?
One
of the premises is false. Good. Well done.
Ask a question. If you put an extra F after the first F, if you came one of your double F ifs,
that would change it completely.
Into a good deductive argument?
No. It would then say if and only if it's Monday, Marianne will be wearing jeans. Marianne is wearing jeans, therefore it's Monday. You would change it from a... I think that would make it a good argument.
Yes,
but you're changing
yes.
the premise.
But you'd be changing the premise.
Yes,
at
I
that
was
point.
Just curious
yeah.
to know that if you just yeah. changed one tiny bit of it.
Well, yes, but you'd be actually making an if into an if and only if is not making a tiny change, it's making a huge change logically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so either a deductive argument is good because its premises are conclusive reason to believe the conclusion, it's truth-preserving, or a deductive argument is bad because its premises are no reason at all to believe its conclusion. So with deduction, it's always an either-or matter. But no inductive argument preserves the truth. So we can't evaluate inductive arguments by appeal to whether or not they preserve the truth. The very strongest inductive argument still doesn't preserve the truth. So we evaluate them according to how strong they are. And of course, strength is a matter of degree, isn't it? So here, an inductive argument is strong if and only if the truth of its premises make its conclusions significantly more likely to be true, and an inductive argument is weak if and only if the truth of its premises makes its conclusion only slightly more likely to be true. And here are some examples. Well, actually, I've asked you a question, but I think it's... Who thinks the one on the right-hand side is the strong one? Hang on, right-hand side. No, that's this one.
That one.
That one. yes, Mike. No, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, okay. Who thinks the one on the left-hand side is strongest? Yes. I mean, that's a very strong inductive argument, isn't it? The sun has risen every day in the history of the universe, suggests that it's highly likely it's going to rise again tomorrow, isn't it? Whereas every time I've seen Marianne, she's been wearing earrings. Next time I see Marianne, she'll be wearing earrings. Okay, it's probably true, isn't it, that every time you've seen me, I've been wearing earrings. But you've only seen me three times, some of you. Is that really enough? Maybe next time you call round to my house at 4 o'clock in the morning, get me out of bed. I promise you, I don't wear earrings in bed. So that's a fairly weak inductive argument. But do you see they both have the same form, if you like? So in each case, you're saying all the things that I've seen like this have been this, therefore the next one I haven't seen will be like this. So inductive strength is a matter of degree, because whether the premises of an argument make the conclusion more or less likely is itself a matter of degree. And inductive strength is not monotonic. Okay, so I taught you that new word. Deduction is monotonic. What that means is you can add anything you like to a good argument. You can't change it from being good. You can't stop it being good. You can add anything you like to a bad deductive argument. Can't stop it being bad. But inductive strength is not monotonic. The addition of a new premise to an inductively strong argument might make it inductively weak. And I've got some examples coming up. And also, the addition of a new premise to an inductively weak argument might make it inductively strong. So let's have a look at how this works. So take the relatively strong inductive argument. Jones confessed, therefore Jones is guilty. Oh, you agree, probably, that's a pretty strong inductive argument. But then add 10 independent witnesses testify to Jones being 100 miles away from the scene of the crime at the time it was committed. Suddenly it looks very weak, doesn't it? And do you see that? So what we've done is we've taken a strong inductive argument, we've added another piece of information, and we've weakened the argument completely, haven't we?
Jones is a twin.
Well, do you remember when I said about ambiguity, we've got to assume that the Jones is referring to the same person in the same context? Okay, or take the relatively weak inductive argument. Jones was present at the sign of the cream. Therefore, Jones is guilty of the cream. and add the extra, which I think you'll agree is a weak inductive argument, yes? Okay. Add the extra premise, Smith, the policeman who tried to stop Jones kill the man, saw Jones plunge the dagger into his heart. I was having fun with that one. Suddenly a weak argument looks very much stronger, doesn't it? So induction is not monotonic. You can strengthen and weaken inductive arguments by discovering new information. You can't do that with deduction. With deduction, if it's good, it's good, it's bad, and that's the end of it.
Are you in danger there of turning an inductive argument into a deductive argument by the addition of the additional statement?
It's very easy to turn inductive arguments into deductive arguments by adding the right premises. Have I done that here?
I would have thought you're in danger of doing that in the second statement.
Well, no, not if Jones died of electrocution. And he might have done, mightn't he? Consistently with that. I mean, I haven't actually said what the crime is here.
Okay.
Yes, I may not be... You can come back to me on that one if you want to later on. Okay, so let's have a look at this. This is exercise three, which is very similar to exercise two. What we want to know now is whether it's being good or bad as a matter of degree or a matter of either or. And whereas last time you identified the good deductive arguments, now you can also identify the bad deductive arguments and distinguish them from inductive arguments. So Tom is a banker, all bankers are rich, therefore Tom is rich. What's that?
Good
deductive, as it was before, yeah, doesn't change. Sue and Tom lead similar lives, but Sue smokes and Tom doesn't, therefore Sue is more likely to die from heart disease than Tom. Stick your hand up when you've got the when you think you've got the answer to that. And so what we want to know, we know that it's not a good deductive argument from the last time, but is it a bad deductive argument or is it an inductive argument?
Inductive.
It's inductive, exactly so. What could we add to that to make the conclusion much less likely?
Why would you want to
Well, just because if we can, we know it's inductive.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. If we can't, we know it's... So what could we add to that?
You could add that Tom's got a bad heart.
Or that Tom's family died of heart disease, died young of heart disease. Yes, that would immediately change the strength of that argument, wouldn't it? So as it is, it looks pretty strong. But we can weaken it immediately by giving a bit of Tom's family history. Is that a question?
When it suggests that Sue and Tom lead similar lives, probably if you leave the first statement out, it might be stronger because Sue smokes and then Tom doesn't, so obviously Sue is more likely to die. When it suggests Sue and Tom lead similar lives, is not true because she smokes and he doesn't, isn't it?
Well, they could lead similar lives apart from that. I mean, they could both exercise, both eat lots of fruit and vegetables, both not eat much animal fat. Okay, what about all dogs are mortal, Lucy is mortal, therefore Lucy is a dog? Put your hand up if you think you know whether that's a bad deductive argument or an inductive argument.
Bad inductive argument.
It's bad inductive argument. Well, how do you know that?
Because of the premises.
Well, tell me more.
Well, you have, it's not true. It's not truth preserving, is it?
It's not truth preserving, and in fact, the premises are no reason whatsoever for believing the conclusion, are they? So whereas with the first one, the premises are conclusive reason for believing the conclusion, with the third one, the premises are no reason whatsoever for believing the conclusion. Okay, that's a bad deductive argument. What about number four? We know that's a good deductive argument, don't we? Okay, what about number five? Is that a bad deductive argument or an inductive argument?
It's
inductive, that's right. Okay, so every person with Huntington's disease who's been examined has had the HD gene on chromosome 4. Therefore, everyone with HD has the HD gene on chromosome 4. What would we want to... I mean, could you add anything to that to make it a bad inductive argument? I mean, as it stands, it looks pretty strong. What might we do to change it into a weak one?
We've only examined 5 people.
Yeah, exactly. If we've only examined 5 people, then actually it suddenly looks a lot less strong. Good. Okay, and the last one was a good deductive one, wasn't it? Good. Okay, so we now know that if an argument preserves the truth, it's a good deductive argument. If an argument doesn't preserve the truth, it's either a bad deductive argument or it's an inductive argument. And we know that if an argument is either good or bad with no matter of degrees or no maybes, then it's a deductive argument. And if it's being good or bad as a matter of degree, then it's an inductive argument. Okay, so that's, we've looked at our first question and our second question. Now let's look at the third. So the third question was, can we evaluate the argument a priori? Now, to be able to evaluate something a priori is to be able to say whether it's good or bad or true or false or whatever, something normative, without experience, without needing to go and look at the world, if you like. You can do it simply from logic on its own. And the opposite is a posteriori, which is when you have to actually go and look at the world. So let's have a look at this. To be able to evaluate an argument a priori is to be able to tell whether the argument is good or bad by appeal only to the structure of the argument and to the logical words used in it, without need of any information about the world. Now, you might want to say you need information about language, and that indeed is true. So you need some information about the world, but you don't need more than information about language and meanings. So these are the logical words, and if, then, not, or, and if and only if. There are other logical words, but we won't worry about those at the moment. And this gives you an indication of what's meant by the structure of an argument. So here's an argument we used last week. If it's snowing, the mail will be late. It is snowing, therefore the mail will be late. Can you see that if you were to take it is snowing as P, then you've got if P, and you've got P here again, and the mail will be late becomes Q. So you've got if P, then Q, P, therefore P. Do you see that the structure of the argument can be brought out just by taking away the sentences in the argument, leaving the logical words? Okay, is this a good argument? Put your hand up when you've decided, rather than yelling out. Up when you've decided. Up so I can see it, because I'll ask when there's a sort of critical mass of people who know or think they know. Okay, what do you think? Is it a good argument?
Yes,
it is, isn't it?
Thank
you. Does anyone know what it means? Does anyone know what a ridge it is?
Yes.
Or what it is for something to be pommel? No? Okay, good. I'm not surprised because I made them up. But you see that actually the content here is completely irrelevant to your ability to evaluate this argument. You really don't need to know anything about the subject matter in order to be able to say that that argument is good. And the reason for that is that what makes that argument good is the way the logical words in it are combined. It's the structure of the argument. It's nothing to do with the content of the argument. And that's true of all deductive arguments. All deductive arguments can be evaluated a priori. Here's another one. Okay, is this a good argument?
No.
It isn't, and you can tell that because this is actually a bad deductive argument, whereas the last one was a good deductive argument. And it's interesting to note that the fact that deduction is a priori actually means that it's topic neutral. This is what makes logic, or deductive logic anyway, such a useful transferable skill, because it doesn't matter what you're talking about, what you're thinking about. If you can recognise a deductive argument, you will be able to evaluate it, even if you know nothing whatsoever about the subject matter. The subject matter is completely irrelevant to evaluating a deductive argument, because what matters is the logical words and the way they're combined.
Excuse me, in the first premise...
Who's speaking?
In the first premise...
Of the last one?
The nonsense words.
That one.
If witches and Pommel meant positive and Havener meant negative, then the first premise in those terms stands up, but it's nonsense.
Well, what you're doing is you're trying to put content in that's going to make it nonsense, but it's already nonsense, isn't it? I mean, you don't need to do anything to make it nonsense. It's nonsense already, but it's still a good argument or a bad argument or whatever it is.
Well, supposing it was called, widgets are positive, then widgets are negative. Now, that is a premise that cannot stand up in logic.
Well, it's true that, it's the content that it, the logic is, what you're saying is it's false.
Yes.
Yeah. But, well, actually, it's not even false because it is meaningless, isn't it?
But if you
if widgets are positive, then widgets are negative. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's nonsensical. It doesn't have meaning.
Yes.
But you only know that from the content that you're putting in there. And my aim in using this is to show that you can decide whether something's a good argument or not without knowing what the content is like, is about.
Either.
So wanting to put in some content that doesn't make sense is not changing my argument at all.
So you could use positive and negative if you didn't know what positive and negative meant.
Well,
why?
I mean, why?
I mean, why would you? But you could.
Okay, what my aim is to show you is that you can tell whether an argument is good or bad, a deductive argument is good or bad, without knowing what the content means. I take it that because you were able to see that the first argument was good and that the second argument was bad, I take it that I've proved my point.
Yes.
Okay? Now, I could go back and discuss. But I'm inclined not to, because I don't see why changing one nonsensical argument into another nonsensical argument is going to gain us anything. Okay. May I move on?
Yes.
I'm not sure I've dealt with your... Perhaps we can talk afterwards.
Marianne, if you replace it with P's and Q's, then it's clear.
It's clear even without
all
P's.
Yeah, well, it is, but if you say all P's are
well,
Q...
Let me carry on, because I'm now going to replace things with P's and Q's, or at least I could show you how. Do you see that these two arguments have exactly the same structure? Anyone want to deny that? Can you help me work out what the structure is using P's and Q's? Let's use that one. If
P,
then Q, P,
therefore
Q. And so here it means it is snowing, and Q means the mail is late. What's P in the second argument? The act produces the greatest happiness of the greatest number, and what's Q?
It is right.
It, or the act, is, to remove the cross-reference, the act is right. Yes, exactly so. So we've got exactly the same structure it does for both those arguments, doesn't it?
Why do you use P and Q?
Instead of R and S or something. Yes, it's just convention.
Convention,
yeah. Yep.
Is a convention to do with pigs and queens?
No, not that I know of. No, I think it's just...
in one of the books.
And actually, some people would use S and M here, just because snowing begins with S and M, the male begins with snowing. But it would be then less relevant to that one. So it's convention that we use P and Q's. Okay, so hang on, here we've got another one. All widgets I've ever seen have been Havener, therefore all widgets are Havener. Okay? Can we tell whether that's a good argument or not? We can't, can we? Why not? You don't know how many widgets you've seen, you don't know what widgets are, and you don't know what it is to be Havener, and you don't, I mean, they're just, you do need to know what the content is, and you need to know something about the content in order to be able to evaluate that argument. So with a deductive argument, it can be evaluated a priori, i.e. on the basis only of its structure and the logical words. If it can only be evaluated by appeal to some background information, some information that you have, then it's an inductive argument. Okay. Inductive arguments can be evaluated only a posteriori, in the light of an understanding of the content of the argument, and by bringing to bear background information about the world. So whereas you can strip the content out of a deductive argument and still determine whether it's a good or bad argument, there's no way you can strip the content out of a good inductive argument and still hope to evaluate it. So, can we evaluate these arguments a priori or not? Jennifer is tall. Jennifer is the bank manager. Therefore, the bank manager is tall. Put your hand up when you've decided whether it can be evaluated a priori. Okay, what do you think?
Yes, it can.
Yes, it can. Okay. So it's the structure of that argument that tells us whether it's a good argument or not. So is it good?
Yes,
it's a good argument, isn't it? What about crocodiles are dangerous, James's dog is dangerous, therefore James's pet is a crocodile? I think I was getting tired at this point. Can we evaluate that argument? Can't we?
It's
a bad deductive argument, isn't it? We can see that it's bad. We don't need to know anything. It's wrong to tell a lie. James telling her mum her hair looked good was a lie. Therefore, James telling her mum her hair looked good was wrong. Can we evaluate that argument a priori or not?
Yes.
I think we can. Is it a good one?
Yes.
It's another good deductive argument. Tomato plants that have been fed well, kept warm and watered frequently, usually thrive. This tomato plant has been fed well and watered frequently, but it's dead. Therefore, this tomato plant hasn't been fed properly.
That's inductive.
That's inductive.
It might not be kept warm, because you want to know why it's dead.
Yeah, why is it dead? I mean, is it just that I pulled it out of its pot? Okay, yes, we'd need to know a little more about that situation, wouldn't we? We'd need to have some background information. What about this one? This looks familiar. If this liquid is acidic, it will turn litmus paper blue. This liquid turns litmus paper blue, therefore this liquid is acidic. It's good. It's a deductive argument. The last two springs were hot and sunny, but the summers were awful. This spring was hot and sunny. Therefore, this summer will be awful.
It's not a priori.
Do we need to bring to bear background information?
Yes.
What sort of background information will we need to bring to bear?
Weather
forecasts.
Weather
data. We need more information. We need more than 2 years' worth of information.
Yes, we'd want a lot more than 2 years, wouldn't we, in order to generate that.
Mario.
Yes.
Going back to five.
Yes.
If the liquid is something other than acidic, it might turn the litmus paper blue too. Or are you bringing to bear some background knowledge?
To be honest, when I was at school...
Let me have a look at that. Sorry, I've got to the point where it's actually quite difficult to... Sorry, if P then Q. Oh, that's a bad deductive argument. Yeah. No, you're quite right. Did we say it was a good one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's because the last one that talked about litmus paper and acidic. No, that's a bad deductive argument. Can you see that? If P, then Q. Q, therefore P. Which is not if P, then Q. P, therefore Q.
Yeah.
Do you see?
Yes.
Got to be careful about that. So that's... a fallacy of affirming the consequent. We'll
what
talk
would
about fallacies
what
later
would,
on.
I'm not sure that three is a good deductive argument.
It's wrong to tell a lie. Jane's telling her mum her hair looked good was a lie. Therefore, Jane... it is.
Well,
it's just not wise.
It's wrong.
I think it's a... Let me just see if it is. So P is, it's wrong to tell a lie. I'll have to do it. I'm going to have to go into the predicate calculus. Excuse me a second. Okay, here's my interpretation. F of x, x is a lie. Okay, w of x is wrong. And s, which is a thing, an action in this case, Jane's telling her mum her hair looked good. So we've got all x, if x is a lie, then x is wrong. Okay, that's the first premise. S is a lie. Do you see we've got that? Mm-hmm. And therefore WXS rather. Both of those are S's. So everything is such that if it's a lie, it's wrong. See, that's the first premise. Mm-hmm. S is a lie. Jane's telling her mum her hair looked good is a lie. Therefore, S is wrong. Jane's telling her mum her hair looked good is wrong. Straight, good deductive argument.
Yep.
Sorry.
Back to the logic.
Oh, good.
But in reality, the premises are probably...
Oh, well, but we're not evaluating...
I'm not questioning the premises.
Okay. Yeah, we're not evaluating the argument at the moment. I'm not saying anything about whether the premises are true or false. I mean, if widgets are happener is nonsense.
One is positive, one is
positive.
One there and one there.
Would it make any difference to five if you put if and only if at the beginning?
It would always make a difference to change an if to an if and only if. Always. I mean, I found that students, when they first start formalising something, will immediately reach for a double arrow, which is the if and only if, when actually all there is an if. Or all there is an only if. And actually, if and only if is very different to if, and it's different also to only if. So yes, it would make a huge difference.
And would that then make it deductively valid? Or a good argument?
It's exactly the same as one we had earlier, when somebody is talking about if and only. So if you have if and only if this liquid is acidic, it will turn litmus paper blue. This, yes, it would be.
Yes, of course it would.
Yeah.
It's all right, that's sort of the question I was going to ask.
Oh, right, that's good. Two for the price of one.
Yeah.
Okay, ooh, exercise to do at home already. Right, well, we've got, in that case, we can wait a bit for that, because I'm sure there must be more questions. Okay, I usually summarise. Have I not done that this week? Yes, here we go. So there's your exercises to do at home, and I will give you the answers to these exercises on your answer sheet next week, so you can have a look at those at home. And so this week we've learned that critical reasoning is normative, not descriptive. Do you remember that something's normative if it involves standards, either moral standards or rational standards, so right and wrong in some sense, it involves norms. We've looked at the fact that there are two types of following from. So there's deductive following from and inductive following from. And we've seen that deductive arguments are truth preserving, or at least they are when they're good. Sorry, I didn't make that clear there, but that should be clear there. Truth preserving if good. They're also such that their being good is an either or matter. Do you remember they're monotonic? Once it's good, it can't be changed to anything else. And deductive arguments are such that we can determine a priori whether they're good or not. And inductive arguments are never truth preserving. No matter how good they are, they don't preserve the truth in that very definite definition of truth preserving that I gave at the beginning. They're also such that their being good is a matter of degree, and they're such that we can only determine whether they're good by bringing to bear our experience, our understanding of the content, and our background information. So, that's it, folks, for today. But we've got time for questions, which is so. Let's see if I can turn this. Does that make it easier? So it makes it easier. Sorry, somebody had a question.
I've got a feeling that you mentioned earlier the all swans are white business as being not good deductive because somebody found black swans. But then later you said that the premises don't have to be true. And that if you said all swans are white, this is a swan, therefore it is white. Even if swans aren't white, surely that's still a good deductive argument, isn't it?
Are swans animals or birds? Let's pretend they're animals. They're birds, aren't they?
No, never mind. They're both.
True.
Yeah. Okay, here's an argument. And here's another argument. Swans are white. The animal in the next room is a swan, therefore the animal in the next room is white. Is that an inductive argument or a deductive argument?
Deductive.
It's deductive. Okay, so, and what about every swan I've ever seen has been white, therefore all swans are white?
Inductive.
So you see that, I mean, I could say all swans I have seen have been white. It would still be inductive, wouldn't it?
But the first one, the top one, the deductive one, is correct, even though it's not true in real life.
It is truth-preserving,
yes.
That argument, even though one of its premises is false. It's that we'll be doing this more next week, and it's something that people find very difficult. And I think there's a sort of argument that goes in some people's heads that validity is good, truth is good, therefore validity and truth are the same thing, but they're not. You can have a valid argument with a false conclusion, and you can have an invalid argument with a true conclusion. So the notion of truth preservingness is very different from truth simpliciter or truth generating.
Can I take you back to the argument about stabbing through the heart?
The plunging the dagger.
Yes, because I think I would argue you're turning that into a deductive argument with a hidden premise.
Do you remember where it was? It was.
Keep going.
I was talking about monotonicity. Monotonicity, wasn't I?
There
we are. Okay.
I would say there's a hidden premise there which turns it into a deductive
argument. Well, no, every inductive argument, you could find a hidden premise that turns it into a deductive argument. I mean, taking that one, every swan I've ever seen has been white. I have seen every swan.
Yeah.
Immediately
yes.
Becomes a deductive argument. I mean, there's no problem with taking an inductive argument and adding a premise to turn it into a deductive argument. We can always do
yes.
that. I don't think I've done that here.
Well, I would suggest the premise is plunging daggers into the heart are inevitably fatal.
Not if you've already killed the chap from... I mean, so you die of an electric shock and then I plunge a dagger into your heart. I'm not guilty of murder. I may have had the intention to murder you, Christopher, but I didn't do it. You were already dead.
It's ambiguous anyway.
What's that?
It's ambiguous anyway, because you don't know who did his refer to. The man, Jones?
Yes, you would have to assume that there's somebody who... I mean, we are assuming that there's somebody dead here, that what killed him was the dagger going into his heart.
But he's not dead because your policeman's trying to stop him.
He might have punched it into his own heart, of course, as well.
Yes, into his own
heart.
That's true.
But we do sometimes have to take it for granted that there is a person here that we're not introduced to. I think in talking about the cat, we talked about her, didn't we? Without making it absolutely clear who we meant.
But you've got three people there. You've got Smith, the police.
Smith.
You've got Jones.
And him.
Who's being killed.
Him.
Yes.
Whoever he is. Yes.
So you've got three people. And it does not say whose heart it was.
No, it's true.
Smith or Jones.
Well, you've got the man.
Yes.
Who is him.
Who is
clearly,
him.
But, I mean, him
heart.
The man.
It's the his that is ambiguous.
Yes.
Because you've got three men there.
Jones tried to stop Jones kill the man, saw Jones plunge the dagger into his heart.
There's only ambiguity, it could be Jones' heart.
I think that any English person who would read that would be an allegoric reference back to this man here. I really do.
Yes, but
and I know you're all English, but I think you're just saying it for fun. One more.
Supporting the point that you made in the about electrocution, you said he could have been electrocuted. But he can, because the policeman's dealing with someone who's still alive. The policeman tried to stop Jones killing the man.
And failed.
Sometimes you get daggers plunged into your hearts without killing you, can you? I don't know. Why are we talking about this? It doesn't seem to be in the slightest bit interesting, can we?
Are you saying overall that when we look as students, try to look at logic, deductive, inductive reasoning, that we basically take subjectivity out of the equation completely?
Not with deductive, inductive argument, because you've got to bring to bear your background knowledge on the argument. With deduction,
yes.
Your background knowledge can be just taken completely out of the equation. Yeah, that's why deduction is something, computers use deduction.
They do, but with the induction, because it's subjective, and however many here would all come up with something, as we just have, something possibly different, does that make it problematic?
Yes, there's a big difference between deduction and induction in that with deduction, we have a very simple mechanical system that can be given to computers. I mean, the computers embody the mechanistic testing evaluation system for deductive arguments. We can't do all deductive arguments that way. I mean, for example, if I say lying is wrong, therefore you shouldn't lie. Now that looks like a deductive argument. It couldn't be the case that that's true without that being true. But we can't mechanistically test that because it seems to depend on the meaning of the word wrong. So deduction, we could do the propositional calculus and the predicate calculus are very powerful systems that we can use to test deduction. But they don't test all deduction. We are deontic logic, which is the logic of morality. It's still very much in its infancy, and there are other. There's also modal logic, which is less in its infancy. By if it is possible, that just means possible. Then it is not.
Impossible.
Yeah, I was trying to think of something more interesting, but. Yeah, I mean, you can see that's a deductive argument, but actually, again, that seems to depend upon the meaning of the word possible there. So we might think that wrong and possible are both themselves logical words, like and, or, if. But if so, they act very differently, and we don't know how they act. But whereas we have a very good system for the vast majority of deductive arguments, if we can mechanise probability at all, it's only a very small part of it. So yes, there is a problem for mechanistic systems because you need to bring to bear all sorts of background knowledge. Yep. Okay, one final question.
Is it correct, the speaker mentioned that it could be subjective, that inductive arguments could be subjective. Is that correct?
I don't like the. I ban undergraduates from using the word subjective till they're in their third year.
I'm way past.
It's not. you need to bring to bear some background information. To that extent, you're bringing your beliefs to bear on it. I'm still, subjective is a subjective state is a state of a subject, a state accessible to conscious awareness. So perhaps subjective is not quite the right word. But it's certainly true that different people can be more or less inductively bold. So some of you here might say, every time I see Marianne, she's been wearing earrings, therefore next time I see her, she'll be wearing earrings, even though you've only met me 3 times. But some of you might wait to meet me 10 times before you're prepared to say that, or whatever. Do you see, so some people are very inductively bold. They'll draw a generalised conclusion from very little evidence, and other people want quite a lot of evidence before they'll draw an inductive conclusion. So there's certainly an element of subjectivity in how inductively bold you are. Right, we'd better stop there. And the presentation for today is down here, as are the arguments for the end of last week and today.